Good morning, everybody. Please take your Bible and open to Psalm, the 91st chapter. Psalm, the 91st chapter, I'd like to read that psalm. The title of the message today, brethren, if you want to put a title on your message, is called A Thousand Shall Fall, taken from this 91st psalm. Interestingly, this psalm does not have an author. God is the author. It does have an author, but it's not an identified author who wrote it. It's an awesome psalm of promise of deliverance and protection in times of great trial. As we read through the psalm, brethren, I'd like to read through all 16 verses just fluidly here. As we read through, I want you to visualize yourself in a situation where you would need this kind of protection. Because we know, brethren, toward the end of this age, there is going to come a time of great, great persecution against God's people. Psalm 91st chapter, verse 1. He who dwells, it says, in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. Visualize God with wings taking refuge under that. Awesome. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. Verse 5, you shall not be afraid of the terror by night. So he said, don't fear, nor of the arrow that flies by day, warfare, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. Key verse 7, 1,000 may fall at your right side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near to you. Only with your eyes you shall look and see the reward of the wicked, because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For He will give His angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In your hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Of course, Satan used the scripture when discussing with Christ about jumping or leaping off the temple, I believe. Verse 13, you shall tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you shall trample underfoot. Because He has set His love on me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he has known my name. He shall call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. Brethren, this psalm is clearly a song intended to encourage great faith, confidence, and trust in God's special protection and deliverance in the day or a coming day of severe trial. I was offered a book recently and asked to read it. And a little different sermon today. I'm going to give you a little bit of a book report up front for the introduction in the beginning. By one of the members here in Raleigh, Mr. Mark McLeod actually handed me the book, asked me to read it. And I said, well, I'm reading about two other ones right now. I don't have time. He said, look at it. If you don't want to read it, you know, give it back. I looked at it, opened it up, and very, very soon afterwards, the book was complete. Went to my wife, handed it to her, and I said, Brenda, I want you to read a book. She said, okay, I've done that to her many times. I said, just read one chapter. If you don't want to read it, just give it back to me. Well, she stayed home that entire day and read the book, so it had an impact on her life, or on her, and it did me as well. It's a book entitled, A Thousand Shall Fall. Now, if you've seen it before, anybody ever read the book in here other than Mr. McLeod, myself, and Brenda? Yes. So we do have somebody else who's read the book. It was written by Susie Hassel Munday. It's a true story of a Sabbath-keeping family who dared to practice their faith in Hitler's Germany. The family included 40-year-old Franz Hassel, and I hope I pronounce these names right. They are German. Franz Hassel, his wife Helene, his 9-year-old son Kurt, 6-year-old daughter Lottie, and 4-year-old son Gerhard, 5 in the family. The writer of the book, in fact, was their last daughter born near the end of World War II. And, of course, her name was Susie Hassel. She got married and it became Monday. I want to share with you a few of the things that Franz and his family experienced in those years. And I'd like to ask you to consider how you would react or have reacted in a similar situation, faced with the same circumstances that they went through. The book begins in 1939 in Frankfurt, Germany, when 40-year-old Franz Hassel and his family were enjoying the Sabbath one afternoon. His daughter, Lot, 6-year-old Lottie, noticed some mail in the mailbox, went over, grabbed it, gave it to her dad, said, "Hey, Dad, we got mail. It's the Sabbath." He looked at it. It looked business-oriented. He said, "Dad, it can wait until after sunset." After sunset that evening, he said, "Let me get through the mail," opened it up, and looked at it and saw a very official-looking document, which he knew what it was, and it blew him away. He could not believe, at 40 years old, he was being drafted into Hitler's army. He went to the recruitment center, as the note said he must do on the Monday. It was Sabbath, the Monday he was to appear. He went to the recruitment center, passed his physical exam, filled out lengthy information, and he said in verse 14 something very interesting. As he went up to the commanding officer, the officer in charge, he said, and I'll be reading some excerpts of his words, at least Susie's words of her dad's words. "Sir," he said politely, "I'm a Seventh-day Adventist Christian and a conscientious objector. I would like to serve as a medic." The officer looked him over and said, "Seventh-day Adventist?" He repeated, "Never heard of it." He called out across the room to a colleague, "Hey, Hans, you know anything about Seventh-day Adventist?" "They're like Jews," Hans yelled back. "They keep the Sabbath." The officer gave Franz a baleful look, and he finally said, "Well, what would you do if you were caring for a wounded soldier and the enemy launched an attack?" Franz said, "I would lie on top of the man and shield him with my body, sir." "Indeed," the officer rolled his eyes and said spitefully, "we have no room in the German army for cowards." He flipped through some papers, wrote Franz's appointment on the intake form. Franz had been assigned to serve as a private in Pioneer Park Company 699. He swallowed. He knew the Pioneers well. At age 18, he had served with them in World War I. The Pioneers were engineering units that prepared the way for the Army to follow. He knew the prestigious Company 699 that was got their direct commission and instructions and directions or orders from Hitler, or from the headquarters, was assigned to the task of building bridges wherever Hitler planned his next advance. "This means," Franz thought to himself, "that the soldiers in 699 will always be among the first Germans into enemy territory." No doubt the officer had put him on the front lines because he hated men who were not supportive of Hitler's war effort. So he told Franz, he said, "Don't stand there, private," Officer snapped, "move on, we have other people to process," and he moved out of the room and told be back there on Wednesday. Wednesday came, Franz gathered his family together for worship service before he left home, knowing it would be a very long time before he came back. His son was talking about some of the uniform he had gotten, and one of the buckles had on it, I can't pronounce the German, but it means "God with us." "Papa," he said, "if Hitler wants God to be with us, he can't be all that bad." "Kurt," Franz said with intensity, "Hitler's an evil man. Never trust what he says. You stay true to God and God only. But come now, let's worship before I have the lead." Franz read from Psalm 91, the scriptures we just read. "Thou shalt not be afraid of the terror by night, nor the arrow that flies by day. 1,000 will fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand. But it now shall not come nigh to you, for he will give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways." Then the family sang their favorite hymn, "A Mighty Fortress is Our God." Afterward, they knelt in a circle, held hands while Franz prayed this prayer. "Our Father," he said, "I've been drafted to be a soldier. You know I have no interest in war and fighting. You know that I found no joy in the battle of the Great War, even when I wasn't a Christian yet, much less so now. Please be with us, Father, as our paths separate. Help me to be true to my faith, even in the army. Help me so that I will not have to kill anyone. Please bring me back safely and protect my family from all the dangers of war at home." It was getting late. They said their goodbyes. He left, feeling in his heart one day they would be back together again. Boot camp, looking at page 18 of the book. Hans arrived at boot camp. Of course, the first thing he had to deal with was, I got to let these people know about the Sabbath. So he arrived there and he said, "Herr Hauptmann," which is a captain, "may I have permission to speak? May I have permission to present two requests?" "Speak out, man. What are they?" "You know, sir, I am a Seventh-day Adventist. I worship God on Saturday as the Bible teaches us to do. I would like to be excused from reporting to duty on my Sabbath day. I do not eat pork or anything else that comes from pigs. I respectfully request permission to receive a substitute whenever pork is being served." Taken by surprise, the captain was at a loss how to respond. Behind him, the accountant and the clerk glanced at each other. They rolled their eyes to the ceiling and tapped their foreheads. Finally, the captain said, "If you can work out the details with the lieutenant, I'm agreeable." So Franz went looking for the lieutenant, whose name was Peter Guts Chalk. He had a nickname which was called Seldom Cheerful. He was not a very nice man. Saluting smartly, Franz repeated his request. Gutschalk's face turned beet red. You must be mad, Private. He bellowed, this is the German army. This battalion's going to war, and you want Saturday off? Under his breath, he spat out, it's just my luck to be saddled with a religious nut. I just want permission, Franz said mildly, to trade work with other soldiers so that my free day falls on Saturday. Gasping for air like a goldfish, the lieutenant roared, get out of my sight. Franz began to walk away, and of course the lieutenant did call back. Whatever you want, the officer continued, but let me tell you this, Heisel, once the advance starts, the war's not going to come to a standstill just so you can keep the Sabbath day. Furthermore, if I see you shirking your duty in any way, I will personally see that you will live to regret it. Remember, I have my eye on you. Franz went back to the barracks, talked to the other men who really wanted Sunday off, traded it out and said, this is going to work out okay. They said they would. Encouraged by that success, he said, let me go to the mess hall and talk to the guy about the unclean meats. So he made his way to the kitchen, went to the head cook. The cook put his, there he explained his dietary principles to the head cook and asked if he could have a substitute whenever pork was served. The cook put his hands on his hips, stared Franz up and down, said, Private Hassel, he said tensely, a lieutenant with a Lieutenant Gertschalk-like flush to his face, creeping up his neck and his collar. Let me educate you about the diet. For breakfast, we have bread, jam, and coffee. For lunch, we serve stew. For supper, we serve bread, sausage, or other meat, sometimes cheese. 4 times a week, you get 2 ounces of butter in the evening, and 3 times a week, 2 ounces of lard. As he talked, the cook became more and more infuriated. You know, Hassel, you really have the nerve. This is the army, not a gourmet cookery that caters to special witches. He wrapped his knuckles in a giant kettle and he gave forth a booming ring. See this? I have one kettle. All the food gets cooked in this one kettle. You eat what everyone else eats, or for all I care, you can starve. I don't care. Pork indeed. He stared closely at Franz's face. I believe you're a disguised Jew. Just you wait. We're going to find you out. Later, as Franz went through the supper line, the cook instantly slapped a extra large portion of sausage into his plate. Franz thought about it and said, what do I do? He stared up and down at the rich, grisly meat. Should he eat what the Lord had forbidden, or should he just eat the bread and go hungry? Later, back in the barracks, he turned to the book of Daniel, read the story of 3 faithful youths who would not touch the king's food. Then and there, he recommitted himself to be faithful to the Lord's dietary guidelines. It did work out so that their barracks was not far from a milk or a dairy store. Actually, across the street, Hans went over and negotiated with them. And every time, of course, they really liked the pork. They liked the meat. They liked the lard. So whenever he had it, he'd just go over, switch out. They would trade out. And it worked all the way through boot camp. And interestingly enough, through the rest of his 6 years in the service. 2 issues taken care of. He negotiated a Sabbath. He negotiated the unclean meats. And of course, he got he was getting milk and cheese and things. The other men were saying, where are you getting this stuff from? And, you know, he just said, hey, God will provide for me. The 3rd issue he had was his daily practice of Bible study and prayer. Franz had been an Adventist since age 20 and had since made a habit of reading the Bible through once a year. Though he knew it wouldn't be easy, he resolved to continue this practice even in the army. Every morning and evening, he sat on his cot reading his Bible and praying. The soldiers went out of his way to disrupt his devotions by telling jokes, followed by bursts of raucous laughter, or by throwing shoes or pillows at him. Soon he had earned the nickname Bible Reader as well as Carrot Eater. Lieutenant Gutschalk was the most merciless in his ridicule. Every opportunity he got, he made fun of Franz and ridiculed him, made fun of him reading, you know, scriptures, you know, about, you know, obviously not being in the, at that time, the 20th century. Ultimately, as time went by, Franz did actually win the respect of his unit. He continued that daily Bible study and that prayer in front of the men. There was nowhere else to go. He did what he could do. Ultimately, many of the men even became involved in the Bible study. And in one time, he had for four hours, he had the officers going through Daniel. And he was explaining to them how there's no way Hitler's army was going to win the war because, you know, because of the image of Daniel 2. Christ was going to come reign. The stone was going to come. He went in great detail and studied that with him. I thought it was a very interesting story of itself. far too much to cover here, but as the book goes on, many different struggles, details, prayers, and miracles occurred to Hans while he was in Hitler's army. A few of the significant events, just in overview. Interestingly, Franz was a natural sharpshooter. He said, I didn't try that hard, I just was great at shooting a weapon. He was very afraid with that gift, if you call it a gift, as they approached Russia, that if they happened to be engaged in warfare, he would potentially kill someone. So his solution he came up with, he said, I got to get rid of this gun. Previous to his situation that I'm about to read to you, one of the other men had become hungry and had actually sold his weapon for food to one of the cities that they had come into or towns that they had come into, and he was summarily executed for giving his weapon to what they considered to be an enemy. Hans was very nervous about the situation he was up against, but he knew he could not hold on to the weapon any longer. He had to get rid of it. So what he did is he got a piece of wood, negotiated a piece of wood from somebody, shaped it with a knife, polished it black, had a special holster made which he kept with him throughout the entire war, and basically put the wooden gun in. He snuck out at night and went into the river and threw his gun, his weapon, his pistol in the river. He prayed in verse 39. This is his prayer. Lord, he prayed, this is my way of showing you that I am serious about not even wanting to kill anyone. I evidently have some natural marksmanship skills, so I don't trust myself with a weapon. Yet now, with this piece of wood, if I am attacked, I have no way to defend myself. I must trust in you to be my protector. My life is in your hands. Lastly, brethren, by being in the pioneer unit, as I mentioned to you earlier, they were always the first into enemy territory. They had to build the bridges. As soon as they came through, 2 days later, the SS came through, Hitler's Secret Service. And right after that, of course, the army followed. One night, the SS happened to catch up with the pioneer unit. Don't remember exactly what happened, but they did catch up with them. And that night, Hans heard splintering doors, screaming women and children, gunshot wounds in the distance. And he got up in the morning and asked his friend, he said, did you hear the commotion last night? He said, yes, of course. He said, what was going on? He said, you don't know? And Hans said, no, I don't know. What do you mean I don't know? He was shocked that Franz didn't realize that the Secret Service was implementing Hitler's final solution, which was liquidation of the Jews in every territory that they came into. With this knowledge from then on, as the pioneers entered the town, Franz would always go in the town immediately, secretly warn all the Jews in the town, get out into the woods, go out into the hills, the SS is following in a couple of days, leave, you know, save your life. The men would see him going around and what is he doing? And his friends would say, oh, he's negotiating food or something like that. You know, he's always trying to do that. So basically they never knew what he was doing, but he did that. On page 73, very interesting situation occurred where actually they had to double back. The pioneer unit was in front. They had to double back a day or so back. And when they got back, of course, the SS was where they were. We read in verse 73, or I'll read in verse 73. A few weeks later, the battle forced the pioneers to return to a village they had left the day before. In the woods, Franz heard German voices shouting and swearing. His curiosity was aroused. Hiding behind trees, he followed the voices. Soon he came to a clearing honeycombed by trenches Russian soldiers had dug. The SS men were driving Jewish citizens through the woods, men, women, and children, several dozens of them. Horrified, Franz realized that these were the Jews who had not heeded his warning a few days before. When they reached the clearing, the soldiers ordered them to kneel facing the trenches. Then row after row, they shot them in the back of the neck and let their bodies tumble into the trenches. Last of all came a mother with her 6 children. Sobbing, the terrified children clung to their mother. Let go of her, the SS men shouted, talking to the children. Brutally, they tore them away, forced them to kneel, and shot them in the neck. Franz has seen enough. Stepping out of the trees, he approached the men. How can you do such a thing and shoot these innocent children? The SS men glared at him. Man, where have you been all your life? One snapped. It's the children especially who have to be killed. If they grow up, they'll become our greatest enemies. Here, grab a shovel. Since you feel sorry for them, you can at least give them a decent burial. Here, cover them up. He tossed the shovel at Franz. The others laughed raucously. Still chorting, they jogged away. Franz felt ill. He had to lean against a tree for a while to regain his composure. Finally, he walked over to the trenches and sadly began covering the bodies with dirt. Suddenly, he stopped. He thought he had heard a moan coming from one of the holes. Yes, there it was again. He dropped the shovel, peered at the bodies. They were still. Then he noticed a small movement beneath one of the children who had been shot with their mother. He jumped into the trench, gently pulled the bloody body of a little girl. She was dead after all, and he just laid it aside carefully. But underneath her, a man was still alive. Mustering all of his strength, Franz picked him up and out of the trench. The man was unconscious but breathing. The bullet had passed through his head. He didn't seem to have bled much. Maybe he could be saved. Franz hoisted the man onto his back, headed to the village. The plan was to get him quietly to his quarters and bandage him there. As he neared the camp, staggering under his load, he was accosted by an SS man. What are you carrying? This man is seriously hurt and needs immediate medical attention, Franz said. The SS man noticed this was not one of the German soldiers. What in the, he screamed. We're killing Jews, not saving them. How dare you interfere? By now, the other pioneers had come running out. Among them, Lieutenant Peter Gutschalk. One glance, and he understood exactly what had happened. He tore the man off Franz's back. As the man hit the ground, the lieutenant put his gun in the man's mouth and pulled the trigger. Hassel, it's you again, he snarled with trembling rage. I should have known. I'm telling you once and for all that I've had enough of your subversive behavior. It's my goal to see you destroyed. You are no better than the Jewish swine you're trying to save. You will not escape me. If I have to, I'll search the earth over for you. There's no room in the new world we're building for people like you. And that goes for your two friends also. There were two other friends that Franz had gotten to know. The open enmity had been declared. He said he didn't know if he'd be killed in the war or be killed by his own men, by his own lieutenant. Franz's wife, Helene, and the children back home had their own struggles to deal with. I'm not going to take the time here to share with you their story. So many things to share about that. But the major back problem back home that they had was the incredible pressure for her and her children to join the Nazi party. If they didn't join the Nazi party, they got no food, no coupons. They ultimately one time withheld all of her husband's pay because she wouldn't join the party. The other issue was the relentless bombing raids. They had bomb shelters that would hold 2,000 people, and in some cases 6,000 people had to crawl into them with the Allied bombing that was just relentless over and over. The third issue was keeping her children out of Sabbaths or out of school on Saturday. And constantly forced by the Nazis, get your kids in school, and she would not do it. She would not do it. Many times she had to come face-to-face with leaders of the Nazi party. Very interesting story. Saturday became a serious issue, which incriminated them as Jewish sympathizers. At one time, she actually hoarded a Jew. There were times of incredible hunger. Once Helene even had to boil a pot of water and plan to add salt in it so they could pretend that they had soup. That very day, the first food basket arrived from America, and the baskets kept coming every day after that. Not every day, but within that time. So interesting, she got the basket, and it said gift basket, and the word gift in German is poison. And when she was boiling her water, she went to the doors, a knock on the door, and out there, and somebody had handed her that. And here's a basket from America. She said, we don't know anybody in America. And saw the word gift and said, it's poison, get it out of here. And he said, no. Mom, you know, that the mailman said, no, that means gift. That's a gift from America. And there was food. So she was able to actually fix her family food that day. Incredible. On May 21st, 1945, Franz Hassel was free at last. Free from the army. As you know the story, the Germans just evacuated Russia. And the war basically came to an end. The Americans came in. To summarize events in the book, brethren, in the 6 years of the war, according to Susie, his daughter, there was only one Sabbath her father Franz had not kept. At the end of the war, during the helter-skelter retreat from Russia, Franz had lost track of time and didn't realize that the Sabbath had passed, one Sabbath that he didn't work out. He always found a way to avoid unclean meats, never once fired his weapon at anyone. And of the original company of 1,200 pioneers, only 7 survived. Only 3 of those were not wounded. Franz Hassel, the man with the wooden pistol, was one of the 3. At the end of the war, back home in Frankfurt, over 80% of the city was destroyed. But the 6 apartment buildings where his family lived were still standing. 1,000 Shall Fall, certainly an appropriate title for that book. Brethren, as I share that story with you today, I'm certainly not It's not my intent to justify or to condone the teachings of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Early on in Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, if you remember, he was accused of having been a Seventh-day Adventist. And he said, no, he never was. He said he did read the literature. He never once attended a Seventh-day Adventist formal Sabbath service. There were three churches he was looking at when he came knowledgeable about the truth. One was a Seventh-day Adventist. The other were the Seventh-day Baptist. And the third was the Stanbury, Missouri Church of God. And as he was looking and studied into the Bible, he recognized that God's church would have the name Church of God. So basically that's where, you know, he started attending and started actually preaching. Interesting story, his autobiography. I do know a little bit about the Seventh-day Adventists because in doing the story, I wanted to read a little bit. So I did. I don't know what they believed in 1939. I don't think they believe everything now that they believed then, based on what, you know, I read here from Susie Hassel. But we obviously they observe the Sabbath day. That's a no-brainer. They don't observe the God's holy days, annual Sabbaths. I do believe that they celebrate pagan holidays. I do believe that I know the day that they do celebrate, or they believe in the Trinity. And to my absolute great surprise, they actually have in their church images, which shocked me. I mean, it really absolutely shocked me. Didn't realize until a couple of years ago, I was going to a friend of mine's daughter's wedding, and it was at a Seventh-day Adventist church, walked in the sanctuary where the service was going to be held, and saw this huge stained glass mural with the world's Christ, image of the Christ, holding a lamb, and of course, other lamb around his feet. As I saw that, I just shocked. How can a church that is so serious about the fourth commandment, you know, straight over their head on the second? And I said, I've got to ask that pastor who's giving this message there with the wedding, why, how they do that in good conscience, not trying to be rude. But as I finally cornered him at the end of the day, and as I was talking with him, I just couldn't bring myself to spoil a joyous occasion for him and have him even worry about that, so I just didn't even ask him. Actually, we started talking about a book he had written on the Sabbath, and as we were talking, he described the book. I said, I've read that book. So his daughter was on the front of it, and he's telling me about a little girl on the front of the book. I said, I read your book. I didn't even realize. But I said, I'll have another opportunity one day to talk to a Seventh-day Adventist, which I did. And I did get an opportunity to talk to another one, and that is Susie Hassel Mundy. I talked to her. I gave her a call. There's something she said in her book that concerned me a little bit, and I thought I would give her a call. In the opening remarks in her book to the reader, she said, paragraph here, this is the story of my family of World War II. The account is based on the recollection of the participants. In writing and on tapes, my parents recorded the events in meticulous detail. My brothers and sister have told me their memories. I should mention, however, that I have taken certain liberties in the telling of the story, particularly having to do with the precise sequence of events and who may have said what to whom. Also, I have sometimes combined two or more people into one when I felt it necessary for clarification and simplification. Nevertheless, my intention was always to illuminate more brightly the truth. It is my hope this book will be an encouragement to God's people during the time of the end. So as I read that, certain liberties, and I thought, I'm going to give a sermon on this book. I really would like a clarification on exactly what she meant by that. So I called her, found her back of the book. She's actually in California. She's a registrar of a university. Obviously does a lot of research and gravitated to that type of role. But she said what she meant when she had taken certain liberties was a couple of instances. She said when she referenced in the book about her mother moving, being evacuated to the Black Forest or running to the Black Forest, she said that didn't happen once. It happened other times. There was another place where the family had been evacuated. Her mother and the kids had been evacuated to Eskenrod. That didn't happen just once. Actually, that happened several times, but she just combined the event into the one for simplification. She said the other big thing was her mother's persecution from the Nazi Party was not just from one person. Usually, if you read about that, she would have an antagonist, a person that she mentioned. She said there were over 16 people during that time that was really giving her a very, very difficult time. But she just used the one source again to simplify the book so you wouldn't be reading and changing names constantly. Too difficult to keep up with just one name. I asked her in any way had she touched, you know, the basic knowledge and truths of what her parents, had they been, you know, altered at all? She said, absolutely not. She said, the book is stands on its truth. She said, you know, she said, I had to do a lot of research. It took her over 30 years to write the book. She went in 1971 to her parents and said, start recording the details. They'd heard it all their lives. Of course, she had lived part of it. But she asked them to start recording and writing down, which they did. But she did extensive research to confirm dates and times and, of course, all about the war. And she said if there was any question about anything accuracy in the book, it would have come out of Germany. She said, I've never heard one word. She said, nobody's ever questioned. And I said, except for me, right? She said, yeah. Her memories of the events, mostly, again, she was born at the end of the war, I think a year before the year or two before the war was over, was what she said, the immense destruction. It was incredible. The hunger and the gift, bastards from the United States. I couldn't let her off the phone, brother, without asking her about those idols. So I told her the story about when I went to the wedding. And I said, Susie, help me understand this. I said, you guys keep the fourth commandment. We do as well. I told her about our church and what we believed and that type thing. And I said to her, I just find it hard to imagine that a church that observes God's Sabbath and all the troubles and struggles and trials that, you know, the you go through with that in this age, even in this age, how you can have an image in worship. Don't you see a conflict with that with the second commandment? And she said, her explanation was, Catholics have images of saints and worship them. And although the Adventists may have pictures, images, they only use them to reference the role of Christ as a good shepherd, but they don't pray to it. Of course, we would disagree with that. And with that, I thanked her for her book. And of course, the time, taking the time to talk with me. Rather than that being said, after reading the story of Franz Hals and his family, I don't doubt that God intervened in his life. Too many things couldn't have been coincidental, assuming that the story is true. God intervened to protect him and his family and bring them through that war. A Sabbath-keeping German in Hitler's army. Think about it. Franz's heart certainly seemed honest and sincere. Mr. Mills talked a lot about that last week. Excellent message. He clearly trusted in God. And rather than before I was in the church, my heart, I believe, was right with God. And that's why he drew me in his church. It wasn't perfect. Actually reminds me of a story I learned from Mr. Armstrong. Again, going back to his autobiography, which I happened to read in review, there was a man that Mr. Armstrong had encountered who actually taught Mr. Armstrong that God healed if you obeyed and if you believed. This man was a part of the Billy Sunday Tabernacle. He's a Sunday keeper. Basically, Mr. Armstrong had him come over. Actually, a neighbor invited him and said, would you like this man to come over? He will anoint your wife and she will be healed. And Mr. Armstrong very reluctantly said, yes, he came over. His wife was on her deathbed. I think the doctor said she had 24 hours, and she was healed immediately. Mr. Armstrong learned a valuable lesson from that man. He said if there was ever a man he had met with the gift spoken of in 1 Corinthians 12, verse 9, he said this man had it. Rather than he kept Sunday. Of course, Mr. Armstrong quickly, after learning, you know, what he had taught him, and this very humble, sincere man, went to him and shared with him the truths that he was coming to understand about the Sabbath, about the resurrection was not on Sunday. And he gave his paper to the man. The man read it, told Mr. Armstrong he'd get back with him, never did. Mr. Armstrong went looking for him. Ultimately, the man went to, or Mr. Armstrong said, did you ever read my paper? He said, yeah, I read it. I sat down with my pastor. We went through it. Long story short, it's dangerous information. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's accurate, but, you know, you can get your head all mixed up. You need to start thinking about Christ, you know, salvation by grace, not by works. And Mr. Armstrong was shocked. Here the man had taught him so much, and here he was trying to teach him, and he couldn't reciprocate. Bottom line is he ran into the man a couple of weeks later, and the man said, I don't know what's happened to me. I've lost my power, or the power of God working through me. And I read the story for yourself, page 342 of Mr. Armstrong's autobiography, volume 1. Incredible, incredible situation. I didn't intend for you to turn over. I actually didn't have it in my notes, but I will read this. Mark the 9th chapter, verse 38, if you want to write it down. John answered Jesus, saying, Teacher, we saw someone who does not follow us casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he doesn't follow us. Jesus said, Do not forbid him, for no one who works a miracle in my name can soon afterwards speak evil of me, for he who is not against us is on our side. And then he talks about whoever gives you a cup of water to drink in my name, because you belong to Christ, assuredly, I say to you, he will not lose his reward. We're going to encounter many people with many different faiths. We don't bring error into this church. Mr. Mills again gave another very strong, powerful sermon about that. You know, that doesn't mean you don't ask questions. If you have questions, you ask questions. We don't come in here bringing, you know, heresy. That's what happened to God's church, and a good portion of it left and has gone away. We got to be careful about judging things in the church, but outside the church, we probably just need to be a little bit careful. As we read, brethren, in Psalms, the 91st chapter, as we read in Psalms 91, God promises 1,000 shall fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near to you, because you have made the Lord your dwelling place. On one hand, we know God can provide miraculous deliverance. I shared with you a modern-day example in 1939. We have so many scriptural examples that wouldn't have time to go through them all here today, obviously. Noah, the children of Israel, Moses, David, Goliath, Daniel in the lion's den. 2 Chronicles 20, we're not going to turn there, but Jehoshaphat's enemies. A man went up against, saw this huge army coming. He said, what am I going to do? He fasted, he prayed, he cried to God. He never lifted a sword. God wiped the entire army out. When he went and they looked over the hill, they sang a song. God said, sing. They sang a song, and he went down, and all the army, Mount Seir and the other guys, just totally wiped out, all dead. They went and gathered the spoil. Clearly, in that case, God, you know, for Jehoshaphat, 1,000 fell at their side, 10,000 at their right hand. For a good example of miraculous intervention, let's look at Daniel, the 3rd chapter. Daniel 3. We know the story. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, made an image of gold, 60 cubits high, width 6 cubits. Put it in a plane, basically said, hey, when the music plays, everybody bow. At that time, in verse 8, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke of the king and said, oh, king, live forever. You made a decree. The Jews don't obey. Verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These three men, O king, have paid no due regard to you. They don't serve your gods or worship the image that you have set up. He got infuriated. He called the three men to him and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what's the deal here? When I play the harp, you bow. Of course, they said in verse 16, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, he said, if you don't, I'm going to throw you in the middle of the burning fiery furnace. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. I don't even really have anything to say, king. If it is the case that you're going to throw us in that fiery furnace, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, in other words, if God does decide not to deliver us, be it known to you, O king, we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image that you have set up. Nebuchadnezzar says was enraged. Fury filled him. He said, go make the fire 7 times hotter. Then he took the three boys, and he put hats on them, trousers on them, coats on them. Imagine the mindset of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as they were being fully clothed to be thrown in a furnace that had already been made 7 times hotter. And obviously they knew this had been, they didn't just start with this. You know, this furnace had been there before. Imagine, hey, put on this coat, put on this hat. They're just packing it all on top of them so they would burn very quickly. Of course, we know the story. They were thrown in. King looked in, said, didn't we throw 3 in there? Why are there 4? And of course, he commanded Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to come out. And it said in verse 27, the satraps, the administrators, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together. And they saw these men on whom the bodies, on whose body the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Yes, on one hand, brethren, we have God's promise of miraculous deliverance. But on the other hand, we have Christ's warning of impending persecution, especially on God's people toward the end of this age. We have powerful examples of faith in the Bible during the severest form of trial, and that is martyrdom. Martyrdom comes from the Greek word martyr or martos, which means witness, the ultimate witness. Turn to Matthew, the 23rd chapter, please. Matthew 23. Christ had some words to say to the religious authorities of his day about persecution. Matthew 23:29, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You build the tombs of the prophets, adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Therefore, you are witnesses against yourself that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, can you escape the condemnation of hell? Therefore, indeed, I'll send you prophets, wise men, and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues or your churches and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel, mentioned in Genesis, 4th chapter, to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, or Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Surely I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. And of course, Zechariah is documented in 2 Chronicles. Most of your Bibles today, if you're reading one like me, New King James Version, the last book in the Old Testament is Malachi. But in the Bible, the original Hebrew canon, probably a few in here that maybe have the Jewish translation, you'll see the last book in the Old Testament is 2 Chronicles. Christ was saying, from Abel to 2 Chronicles to Zechariah, all that blood's going to come back on your head. Of course, he knew, you know, many times he was talking to Satan. In this case, I believe he was talking to Satan as well. You know, confirmation to me that there is coming a time when that sin, that penalty will be placed on the head of those perpetrators of the evil, namely Satan the devil. These two deaths, brethren, are bookends of persecution of God's people in the Old Testament. But we know, as Christ prophesied, murder was not going to stop. Martyrdom was not going to stop with the Old Testament. John the Baptist was beheaded, the Son of God. Jesus himself was crucified. Stephen was stoned to death, the first martyr of the New Testament church. Stephen was stoned to death. James, the brother of John, right after that, was killed by Herod with the sword, implying beheading. First of the apostles to be killed for the sake of the gospel, and the only one that was recorded in the Bible, again, that was James. There's a book called Fox's Book of Martyrs, written back in the 1500s, and it talks about the fate of the other apostles. Check my time here. It talks about the fate of the other apostles, just a few of them I won't mention because we just don't have much time. Philip, who served in Upper Asia, was scourged in Phrygia, Phrygia, I guess, thrown in prison, later crucified. Matthew, the tax collector, was slain with a halberd, a shafted weapon with an axe-like cutting blade, and a speared in the city of Nadaba in A.D. 60. Matthias, the man who was chosen to replace Judas as the apostle, was stoned in Jerusalem and then beheaded. Andrew, the brother of Peter, was crucified on a cross at Edessa. The ends of his cross were fixed transversely across the ground, thus the derivative of the term St. Andrew's Cross. Peter, it was said, was crucified with his head down, feet up, because he thought himself unworthy to be crucified in the same form and manner as the Lord. Paul, as we know, as documented very clearly in the scriptures, was persecuted several times. He was scourged, stoned. Finally, Nero had him beheaded by a sword. Many others were written that apparently in 1500 that Fox had done great research on, going back to the early Christian writers to find out what happened to these men. In secular history, brethren, and Fox again documented those things, there were what he called 10 primitive persecutions mentioned in his book. The first mass persecution occurred under Nero in AD 67, 30, 35, 36 years after Christ was crucified and then resurrected. Nero was the sixth emperor of Rome. Of course, he gets this from Tacitus' writing, who lived 56 AD. He was an important Roman or historian of Roman antiquity. He lived from 56 AD to 117. He wrote a couple of works. One of them was called Annals, which you can read if you want to go into your encyclopedia and see exactly what he said. But to summarize, Nero in AD 67 set Rome ablaze and then blamed the Christians for the deaths and destruction caused by the fire. He had some Christians sewn up in skins of wild beasts and thrown to the dogs. Some Christians were dressed in shirts made with stiff wax, fixed to axle trees, and set on fire in his gardens in order to illuminate them. Rather than diminish the spirit of Christianity, this persecution increased the devotion and the commitment of Christianity. He talked about the other nine, which I won't go through. Many, many, many Christians killed, murdered. Christ talked to a lot of his disciples about the persecution that was going to come as a warning for them, but also to prepare them mentally, spiritually, that they would know what to expect and how to handle themselves in such situations. We're in Matthew, so let's go to Matthew, the 10th chapter. And let's read some of Christ's direct encouragement, admonishment to the 12 disciples. Matthew 10, verse 5. These 12 Jesus sent out and commanded them, saying, and then there's a long dialogue of information or a discourse of information where Christ talked with them. And he said in verse 16, talking to the 12, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourging in their synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake to as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles." They had to be brought because they were going to be a testimony. Verse 19, "When they deliver you up, don't worry about what you're going to say. It will be given to you in that hour what you need to say. For it's not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who is in you, who speaks through you." Then he talks about who the persecution will come from. Verse 21, "Now brother will deliver up brother to death, father his child. Children will rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. You will be hated by all for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end will be saved. When they persecute you in this city, go to another one," he said. Verse 25, "Is it enough for a disciple to be like his teacher and a servant like his master? If they have called me Beelzebul, or Lord of the flies, if they call me Prince of Satan, how much more will they call those of his household? Don't fear them." He said in verse 28, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." Disciples, in hearing this, had to be shaken. Christ said, in words for us to remember in encouragement, if we go find ourselves going through persecution, verse 29, "Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin? Not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will. Even the very hairs of your head are numbered." So when that time comes, remember, a sparrow doesn't hit the ground. Remember, the sparrow doesn't hit the ground without our Father being aware of it. Verse 34, "Don't think I've came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I've come to set a man against his father, daughter against her mother, daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves his father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son and daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who finds his life will lose it. He who loses his life for my sake," and he was telling them they would have to do that, "he who loses his life for my sake will find it." Luke 21, that admonishment Christ gave directly to those 12 disciples as he sent them out, applies for the end of time as well. Luke 21 basically mirrors the words he spoke to the 12. They came to him, they said, "Teacher, what's going to be the end? Give us some signs. Help us to understand what the end of time is going to be like." The Olivet prophecies we're very familiar with. He said to them, verse 10, Luke 21:10, "Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes in various places." Verse 12, "But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake, but it will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. Therefore, settle it in your hearts, not meditate beforehand what you're going to answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all of your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death, but you will be hated, and you will be hated by all for my name's sake, but not of a hair of your head will be lost. Not a hair of your head will be lost, but you will be put to death in some cases," he said. There's going to come at the time of the end severe persecution. If you read the scriptures to follow, we know it talks about the Great Tribulation. Turn to Revelation, the 6th chapter and verse 9. Again, very strong words, scary words, to be quite honest with you. As I was looking through these things, and I've read them before, we all have, it's kind of putting them together thinking, wow, this is a bit intimidating. Revelation 6, verse 9. "When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the souls, under the altar, the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? Then a white robe was given to each of them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren, who would be killed as they would be killed, as they were killed, would be completed. Turn to Revelation 12. Back to the theme of the message here today. 1,000 will fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand. Revelation 12, scripture we all like a lot. I really like these scriptures in Revelation 12. Not at the beginning, but kind of toward the end. We know in verse 7 there's going to be a war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. They have fought, you know, since the beginning of this planet. It got in the situation it was in because there was a war. But apparently toward the end of the age, there's coming a time when there's going to be another major event. If you look at this sequentially, which we can only understand it that way. That's the way it reads. Of course, the Satan, it says, was thrown, verse 9, Revelation 12, 9. So the great dragon was cast out of heaven, that serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Heaven will be rid of him once and for all. He will not go back up. He makes these trips, apparently, and it's kind of hard for me to understand, but even today, perhaps, he makes trips until this event occurs. But we know in Job's time, he was talking with God. He went up to report, where have you been, Satan, walking around the earth? So, you know, I don't understand all that. But if you take it literally, which you have to, he does have access to the throne of God. There's coming a time when he will have no longer access. And then verse 12, the scripture says, prophecy says, John's prophecy, therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you that dwell in them, but woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down on you having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time. He's going to be very angry when this event occurs that kicks him out of heaven. Verse 13, when he saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. The woman was given two wings of an eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, where she's nourished for a time, times and half a time, prophetically times or years. 3 1/2 years, a year, 2 years, and then half a year. The serpent spewed out water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away. But the earth helped the woman and opened its mouth and swallowed the flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. So there is coming a time when the church, we believe, will be taken to a place of safety. 1,000 will fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near to you, those who go to this place of special protection, the secret place of God. Verse 17, there will be others who are left behind. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring. And who are those? Who are the identifying signs of those at the end of time? Those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Must have both. As I mentioned in a sermon I gave not long ago, not just one. Got to have both. The testimony of Christ and keep the commandments of God. So he's making war with them, the ones who are left behind. The ones who are left at this time. Revelation 13, very strong words, verse 5 through 8, talking about the beast. And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Again, time times half a time. 42 months, 3 1/2 years. Verse 6, and he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God. Imagine the audacity of this beast to open his mouth and blaspheme the God of heaven. And not just God. He blasphemed his name, his tabernacle. He blasphemed the throne of God and to those who dwell in heaven. All the angels and anybody who has anything to do with God, he blasphemed all of them. Verse 7, and it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. If you read Daniel, the 7th chapter, it talks about the beast prevailing over the saints, persecuting them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. All who dwell on the earth will worship them, whose names who have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the world. Look at verse 20, verses 4 through 6. Verse 20, verses 4 through 6. Angel comes down, binds Satan, and then John sees another vision of those who judgment has been committed to. Verse 4, Revelation 20, verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they who sat upon them, judgment was committed to them. Then I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, had not received his mark in their foreheads and in their hands. Mark of the beast. What in the world is that? I don't know. You've heard you hear anything today from something implanted in the skin having to do with technology, because, you know, it's going to happen at the end of time. Certainly this is a technological age. You've heard Sunday keeping, probably heard that. I've heard that before. Came up understanding that the mark of the beast perhaps was Sunday worship. Saw something that came up on the internet 2 days ago. Minister claims he's Jesus Christ. Jose Luis de Jesus Miranda says he's Jesus Christ reincarnated. The spirit that's in me is the same spirit that was in Jesus of Nazareth, he told CNN News. Called daddy by his followers and by his thousands of followers in some 30 countries, the man has a tattoo with the number 666 as a symbol of the Antichrist, and his followers are getting similar tattoos. The followers of DeJesus say they have proof he is divine and that their church, growing in grace, is misunderstood. Now 61, DeJesus grew up in poor Puerto Rico, served several sentences in prison for petty theft. He figured out he was a reincarnated Jesus Christ when angels visited him in a dream. He said, the prophets, they spoke about me. It took me time to learn, but I'm what they were expecting. What they've been expecting for 2,000 years, DeJesus told CNN. DeJesus is a self-described former heroin addict, lives lavishly. He travels in luxury cars and wears a diamond Rolex. He says, Antichrist is the best person in the world, he tells CNN. Antichrist means don't put your eyes on Jesus, because Jesus of Nazareth wasn't a Christian. Antichrist means do not put your eyes on Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus of Nazareth put it on Jesus after the cross. And he wants you to believe that Jesus after the cross is Jose Luis de Jesus Miranda. And people are following this wacko. It amazes me. Well, we don't know what the mark of the beast is for sure. If you look at our book on Revelation, it talks a little bit about it. Certainly much to learn, and there will be much more taught to God's church as we near that time. I don't think it's going to be a brand 666 on somebody's forehead, though. But don't know. I certainly can't tell you. In summary, brethren, we see the contrast that on one hand, God promises miraculous deliverance. 1,000 shall fall, 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near to you. On the other hand, Christ prophesied and promised persecution, in some cases, to martyrdom. Turn to Hebrews, the 11th chapter. We look at those two contrasting views. Hebrews, the 11th chapter, of course, the faith chapter, toward the end of the book, shows that contrast in verse 32. Hebrews 11, 32. What more shall I say? For the time would fail to tell me, talking about those who were delivered through faith. Time would fail to tell me of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and of David and of Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned the fight of flight of the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead back to life again. And then look at the second part of the verse. So we have the deliverance on one hand, 1,000 shall fall. On the other hand, persecution. Others were tortured, again, faith, through faith, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had the trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted, were slain with the sword. They were wandering about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom this world is not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in dens, in caves of the earth. In both instances, God's people, whether it was a deliverance of 1,000 shall fall, or persecution unto martyrdom death, were shining examples and testimonies of incredible faith, incredible patience, and incredible endurance. I ask you today, are we ready for persecution if it comes our way? We think of persecution, you know, I told you a story about when I was a kid. Friends made fun of me. Sabbath conflicts. If you have a job, you work in this age, you're probably going to run into that. I certainly did. School trials. My daughter Jacqueline wanted to play basketball. Couldn't play on Friday night. Coach said, we won't cut you from the team. Guess what? He didn't even let her practice with the team. You know, there's some persecution that happens on a lower end level. It still hurts, but it's certainly not to the extreme that we have talked about here, that Christ talked about. A few final thoughts to keep in mind as we go forward into the future and we may find ourselves as victims of persecution. Turn to 1 Peter, the 4th chapter. A few more scriptures and we're done. 1 Peter 4, verse 12. Beloved, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial. And every time I hear the word fiery trial, I always think of the three Jewish boys, or boys from Judah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange things happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake in Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may be glad with exceedingly joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, happy are you, for the Spirit of the Lord and God rest on you. On their part, he's blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. Let none of you suffer as a murderer. And he goes on and on. So how do you count it joy? Blessed are you. Count it with exceeding joy. We won't turn over, but in Acts the 5th chapter, that did happen. Peter and the other apostles were thrown in prison by the high priest and by the Sadducees. God delivered them from the prison. He told them not to speak anymore. They get out of prison. They're walking around preaching Christ again. They go get them back. They drag them in. They said, we told you not to do this. And they beat them, it said. And then their words in Acts 5, verse 17 or verse 40 said, and they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. They did not cease teaching and preaching Jesus Christ, Jesus as the Christ. Count it joy. They were able to do that with the Spirit of God. Number two, there is no dishonor with intimidation in the face of persecution. I mean, let's face it, the Son of God, you know, had a little trouble with it himself. We won't turn over, but you can put in your notes Mark the 14th chapter and verse 36. He went to the garden and he prayed because he knew that night he was going to be betrayed. He took his closest disciples with him, asked three of them to go even further with him into the garden to watch with him. And he said, Mark 14, verse 36, quote, Abba, Father, Daddy, Father, all things are possible for you. All things are possible for you. Take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. And he did that three times. Three times he said, if there's another way, please let's come up with another way. I really don't want to have to go through this. Why else would he have prayed that? I'm not saying he was afraid and he knew what he had to do. But he said, if there's a way, take the cup away. Let's always ask if we find ourselves in that situation for deliverance. God, please, is there another way? I really don't want to be lit on torch lighting gardens for Nero. I mean, think about that. How cruel is that? But we must consign ourselves to do God's will. If it has to be, then it has to be. The third point is God will provide the necessary strength and encouragement to enable you and I to endure very, very severe persecution and trial. In Luke's account of the garden experience, I don't think Mark had it, I don't think Matthew mentioned it, but Luke's account said that an angel from heaven came to Jesus and strengthened him. He needed strengthening at that very moment. Stephen saw heaven open. He saw a vision. He was being stoned to death and looked up and saw heaven open. Wow. You know, how powerful can that be? You're about to be persecuted and you see heaven's open and you see the Son of Man standing up, not sitting down, but standing up at the right hand of God as he was being stoned. That had to be encouraging. God said, don't even worry about what you're going to say. If somebody told me, Kim, you're going to go talk to President Bush tomorrow, we need you up at Washington. And I've been to Washington to talk to some senators. You get a little intimidated. You get your notes together. You know, when I went in and I was doing some things for the IPC and talking to our senator staff on behalf of the IPC organization, I made sure we had our ducks in a row. Christ said, when you go, don't think about it. Don't even meditate beforehand. Don't worry. I will speak through you. Interestingly, brethren, the disciples, every one of them, when Christ was smitten, when he was taken, they scattered like scared chickens. No one was to be found. Everybody left him. But as soon as the Holy Spirit came in them later, these are the same guys that said, thank you for letting us be beaten in Christ's name. They were glorifying in that. The power of God's Spirit can give you and me the courage that we need if it comes to that. Number four, we must ever be conscious of the fact that if we are being persecuted, then Christ is experiencing the same suffering with us. Again, he stood when Peter was being stoned. You know, we're all one body, as Mr. Cox mentioned, about that fellowship. My nose hurts right now. I got a sore on the end of my nose. My whole body comes to aid my nose. I was in there just last night. I was doctoring it, putting all kinds of stuff on it. Had a cold sore in it, and it just, boy, it hurts. You bump it or you rub it. I mean, your whole body cringes. Your hand comes up to protect it. Your hand, you know, taking care of it. My eyes are looking at it in the mirror this morning. You know, that one little piece of my body, the whole body is concerned about it. When Paul was persecuting God's church, Christ met him on the road to Damascus and said to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" And he said, "Who are you?" And of course, Christ said, "I am Jesus whom you're persecuting." He was persecuting the church, but Christ was feeling that pain with them. It's an incredible thing that Jesus is there with us in that. And the fifth and final thing, in God's eyes, it's hard to give this one, but in God's eyes, it's actually a very great blessing and reward. Turn to Matthew, the fifth chapter, to be persecuted. You're thinking about payback, reward. You do something, you get reward for it. Matthew, the fifth chapter, and verse 11. Everybody wants to be rewarded in this age with money. Matthew, the fifth chapter, verse 11. "Blessed are you when they revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Brethren, we do not know exactly what God has in store for us regarding persecution, but we do know that God is fully capable of miraculous deliverance that we read about in Psalms, the 91st chapter. 1,000 will fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near to you. That can happen. That will happen to the church in the place of safety, the church when the woman is taken away for a time and half a time. That will perhaps happen to us even in this age. You know, we don't know when the time of the end is. But God is fully capable of providing that miraculous deliverance. We also know that Jesus Christ said in John 15, verse 20, "If they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. Servant's not greater than his master. If I got it, you're going to get it." And he warns us of great impending persecution at the end of the age. My point is, brethren, that we need to be prepared for whatever God chooses for us individually. Whether it's miraculous delivery in a place of safety, or severe persecution, even to the ultimate witness, which is martyrdom. Regardless of what comes our way, let's commit to maintain our faithfulness to those two identifying signs of his people at the end of the age, those who keep the commandments of God and those who bear faith of Jesus, have testimony of Jesus Christ. If we are faithful in those two things, even in the face of great adversity, we can have great faith and confidence that as those who went before us, that God will strengthen us and God will see us through, as Mr. Jenkins had us sing earlier. Have a great Sabbath.